welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to a fresh new week. I am glad you could join me for another episode. I'd like you to take a moment and think about the city that you live in. Are there parts of your city that you return to again and again? And what is the reason for that? Are there parts of the city that you consciously avoid, even though to get to where you're going will take you a little long if you don't go through that part of the city? Are there other parts of the city that inspire fascination and curiosity? How about, are there avenues or parks where you feel you can feel relaxed and safe? Are there parts of the city where you feel on edge, where you need to constantly feel you have to look over your shoulder? And it's no surprise to any of us that how our environment is affects our psychology, affects our sense of well-being. It affects how we interact and engage with the day and the people around us. Well, this week's episode is about the urban environment and how that urban environment shapes our mental states and can contribute or take away from our sense of well-being. Well, this week I am joined by Jenny Rowe. She's the co-author of Restorative Cities, Urban Design for Mental Health and Well-Being, which looks at how city planners and architects can approach the design of cities with mental health in mind. Jenny Rowe is also professor and director of the Center for Design and Health at the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. She's an environmental psychologist and a former head of landscape architecture for an international architectural practice. She writes lectures and consults for a wide range of academic and public audiences on human health-centered design for the built environment. Jenny is also an expert in restorative environments that support mental health, including an important role for public parks and urban green space. Well, I found this episode with Jenny to be very interesting and fascinating, and I hope you will find the same. You won't look at your city and your surroundings in the same way after listening to this episode. Well, let's slip into the stream and meet Jenny Rowe. Well, welcome, Jenny. I appreciate you showing up to the podcast. I was wondering, maybe we could begin the conversation by you introducing yourself and what you do.
Of course. So my name is Jenny Rowe. I'm a professor of design and health. I'm based in two places, really. The University of Virginia, where I direct the Center for Design and Health. And then I'm partly also in the city of Edinburgh in Scotland, which is where I sprung from and where I go home to in my summer and winter recesses from the university here in the US.
Oh, thank you for that. The reason I wanted to have you on, I just recently finished your book, Restorative Cities, Urban Design for Mental Health and Well-Being, that you co-authored. I really liked the book. For me, it was very straightforward and very clear and concise. And I think the way you articulated each of the chapters really hit home to me. There was one quote that really stood out to me. I mean, there was a number of it, but you said restorative urbanism means putting mental health, wellness, and quality of life at the forefront of city planning and urban design. I was wondering, maybe we could begin the conversation by you speaking to what is a restorative city? What do you mean by that?
Well, maybe I'll start with your quote first, if that's okay.
Please,
yes. That's really the essence of restorative urbanism. So Layla and I... Layla, by the way, is a psychiatrist and the director of NHS Confederation in the UK. We met around 2018 to discuss why urban design had paid so little priority to mental health. Mm. So you will know, and I'm sure your audience will know, that there are drives in cities to improve physical activity. There are guidelines for increasing activity in terms of walking and cycling in cities. But too much of, let's say, transportation policy has been about getting people from A to B in the most efficient way possible. So when you talk to transportation planners and designers of our cities, they are concerned with ease and efficiency. And so are we. We want to get from A to B as quickly as possible. But getting from A to B also has an impact on our social health and our mental health. And later on, I felt that this had really been ignored. Nobody was thinking about mental health in relation to how we design our, particularly our outdoor environments. So restorative urbanism, to answer your original question, derives its name from a huge body of research and theory in restorative environments, which sprung from the field of environmental psychology around the 1980s. And what the theory suggested was that certain attributes in our environment, and we can come back to those environments, there are certain qualities of our environment that have a significant and positive effect on our mental health and well-being. So that's fundamentally what restorative cities is about. It's looking at those qualities of environment and pulling together the evidence that shows a relationship between those qualities of space and our mental health. For instance, we know that green space and being around green space, being in it, looking at a view to it, has a super positive effect on our mental health and well-being. And when, so that's one of the attributes we hone in on the book. Yeah.
And when you mean green space, you mean parks and parkettes and such, pocket parks?
Yeah, good question. They can be pocket parks. They can be national parks. They can be local neighborhood parks. They can be any scale. They can be the plants you might grow on your balcony window. Okay. They can be even what you look at in terms of a screensaver on your computer. There's evidence to show that 45 seconds of looking at a restorative scene on your computer can help restore your kind of mental fatigue. So there's all sorts of studies looking at all types of green space. Some of them look at those aspects of green space virtually, in virtual environments. I'm not particularly interested in that. I'm more interested in what, you know, the real world delivers to us in terms of its benefits.
You know, after reading your book, what really became very salient for me was during COVID, when the lockdowns and we had to retreat back behind our own walls, our homes, our apartments and such. And I was just wondering, with that in mind, you know, what issues did COVID raise about urban design in your head?
Well, COVID raised huge issues in terms of both safety of public space. You know, how do we actually get our daily dose of, let's say, exercise outdoors and stay safe? Mm-hmm. How do we go to our local shop? And how do we keep a certain distance that was prescribed, certainly in the UK, of I think it was 2 meters. But also, our neighborhood was the environment in which we met our neighbors, our friends. It's where we played. It's where we chatted. It's where we had a coffee outdoors, maybe. It's where we walked and cycled. So suddenly, your local neighborhood took on a different perspective. It became those pockets of outdoor space became hugely used. I mean, in London, local neighborhood parks were overrun with people. My own local neighborhood park in Charlottesville was overrun by both cars from people driving to it, but also people using it. It sometimes didn't feel very safe because of the sheer volume of people walking on, let's say, the Riverside Trail. So the public became much more appreciative of what was on their doorstep. And I think that there is still a very big public demand for more parks, pocket parks, neighborhood parks, improved access to those parks, and a better distribution of them, because we know that the distribution of parks, certainly in the UK, certainly in the US, is not equitable. The people who live in the poorest areas have not only the worst quality parks, but they have least access to those parks. So the distribution of these attributes, we might call them salutogenic attributes of space, attributes of space that support and build health and well-being, is not equitable. And that is what COVID did show.
I mean, could you speak more to that sort of equity of access? Because I think that was a, I thought that was a very, for me, that was very something that resonated with me when I read your book. Maybe could you speak more to that? Could you elaborate what you mean equity of access and maybe how it shows up?
So the power of evidence, let's just stick with parks for now, but the evidence shows very clearly that parks bring a whole host of both direct and indirect benefits. So those direct benefits include lower air pollution, lower noise pollution. This has an effect on your risk for chronic health disease. You are less likely to get cardiovascular disease or cancer or diabetes or be obese if you live and use and have access to a local park. Now, that also extends into your mental health. We know, for instance, that schools that have access to urban green space, both productivity, both memory performance, increases in the children who have access to that green space. The risk of autism is reduced. There's a huge body of evidence around this, and that's partly what the chapter on the green city does in the book. It brings that evidence together in a very, very simple and diagrammatic way, because really one of our missions in this book was to put that evidence in a simple graphic for very busy people like who govern and direct our health policy, our recreation policy, our social policy in our cities. So they have it to hand. They haven't got time to read the book necessarily. And people in policy have said that about the book. They've said, Jenny, this is great because I can see the benefits in a simple diagram. I don't have to read the entire book. But the evidence is there for people in public health who really need that concrete, robust scientific evidence, excuse me. Right. I can't relay how powerful some of this evidence is in relation to both physical health and mental health.
Because when I was reading the book, I live in Oslo, Norway. I'm a Canadian who's here in the land of Vikings. And what I read, when I read through all those, you had the inclusive city, you had the sensory city, the blue city and such like this. It kind of, when I look at Oslo and how they've developed over the last 15, 20 years, I can almost like, if it was a checkbook, I could almost check it all off. Because one of the things that really stood out to me was also the blue spaces you speak about. Because we have the waterfront here and we have the lakes up in the woods and such. I was wondering, could you speak to how important it is for us to have access to blue spaces, such as rivers and waterfronts and such, and why that is so beneficial to our mental health and well-being?
Of course. So I've not been to Oslo, but I have been to Copenhagen and Stockholm, cities which both have terrific access to water. And water is one of the most restorative attributes in our environment. And that's partly because it's dynamic. Mm-hmm. So there's a really critical psychological process associated with a restorative environment, and it's called fascination. You might also interpret that as curiosity, about awe. And water provides an abundance of fascination because it is this dynamic quality. It changes in terms of light and how light falls on it. So it changes its patterns and its course as it falls over different materials. So in any form, be it a soft form, a natural form, such as a pond or a river edge, or a hard engineered water feature, you know, such as a fountain, all of these bring kind of delight and curiosity into our world, and we engage and interact with that. And that's why water has this kind of effect on our psychological processes. It relieves our stress, it recovers our attention, it improves our mood, and it has this dynamic quality.
And I guess that speaks to, some cities obviously may not have rivers per se or access to the ocean, maybe the lakes, but I mean, are fountains part of this, sort of fountains you might find in a city square and such to help that?
Absolutely. So a city I love to cite in relation to a really good example of a blue city is Sheffield in the north of England, in Yorkshire. And they have, I think, one of the world's only blue space master plans. And so the minute you arrive at the station in Sheffield, you are greeted by this extraordinary fountain, which is a reference to the city of steel. I mean, Sheffield no longer manufactures steel, or if it does, it does so on a very small scale. But they've used water engineering to really reference that city's industrial past. And they've used a connected series of water features to link the city together. And so it's a joy to really visit that city. And you go into the central square, City Hall, and even in a grey kind of temperate climate, there's these fountains bursting out everywhere, which children just love to interact with. There's just water everywhere. And I don't know whether it's testimony to the fact that Sheffield has a really strong school of landscape architecture, but the city, in terms of green and blue space, is really quite a delight and quite unusual to find that being used in a city that is calling out for regeneration. They're using these attributes to really raise the profile and the appearance, the aesthetic appearance of a city, and to reduce the stigma of a city which has really seen some hard times. So it's really fascinating.
So Sheffield's being able to combine, as you said, the blue city, the green city, inclusiveness. It also sounds like it's very playful. And so this goes to one of those, you said fascination is one of the core attributes of restorative urban design. So, I mean, the way they've linked these water parks or these fountains or this whole sort of pathway per se, is this mm-hmm. part of what you're talking about? It triggers the curiosity because it's dynamic, it changes, it's not static.
Absolutely. And nor is nature. Nature is not static in a city either. Mm-hmm. And if you just look very closely and carefully at nature, it is quite extraordinary, and it's changing all the time. It's changing seasonally, but it's also just changing during the course of a day as light falls on nature, on trees, on leaves, on water, with a different type of intensity, and creates different kind of patterns. I should just add there's three other attributes. So there are four psychological processes associated with restorative environments. The first I've talked about, which is fascination. The second is a sense of being away, a sense of just being able to escape from your everyday stresses. And again, nature is abundant in that ability to draw us out of our immediate environment and provide a sense of being away, even if it's just momentarily for a few minutes. The other two categories are a sense of extent. So extent has been variously interpreted. Some people perceive it as providing a legible and coherent environment. It makes sense if an environment's going to be restorative that you can find your way around it and navigate through it easily. I tend to interpret extent as a sense of connecting to some kind of other world, looking up and out of your horizon. So I don't know how, do you have any hills in Oslo?
Yeah, so Oslo, the center of Oslo is based sort of at the head of Oslo Fjord, and then there's hills that rise out of the city, kind of gently rises out onto the suburbs, kind of rise up into the hills, and then that's surrounded by deep forest.
So just getting a sense, just climbing, even just albeit a series of steps in a city, and getting a view up and out over a city, perhaps to something beyond, like to the hills and the forest that you're talking about, this connects you to a slightly different world. So that's also a very restorative psychological process. And the other category, which makes complete sense, is that any environment has to be really compatible with your needs. So let's say you have some difficulty in either your cognitive abilities or your physical abilities. If you're struggling in an environment to find your way, to navigate, to understand and to read an environment, it cannot be restorative for you. So we have different, we're all on a different spectrum. Mm. And we all experience our environment slightly differently. But these four qualities have been shown through thousands of studies, robust studies, to be particularly pertinent to our mental health.
So just to understand, because I think those four points are very, because my background is clinical and cognitive psychology. And the whole reason I started this, Jenny, this podcast was to talk about resilience. And so fascination, curiosity, when I travel to Europe and cities, I'm very attracted to the Altstadt, the old part of the city, because the architecture is so varied. It's not sort of this static glass and steel that you see in a lot of modern cities, especially North American cities. I'm originally from Toronto. You can see condos everywhere. So fascination is one of them. And then you said the sense of getting away. So does that mean sort of, you said a place where you feel safe, a place you can retreat to. Would that be to like a favorite park or to sit on a park bench looking out on a river? Is that what you speak of, that sense of getting away? Or is that retreating to home?
You don't have to physically move your body to get a sense of being away. Mm. So, for instance, you or I could put a piece of music on and it would take us away, perhaps, into another space. So similarly, with your environment, you could look out of the window. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I have a garden to look at, which changes, you know, day by day. And so I can get up from my computer and go and look out of my window and get a 3-minute dose of nature and a sense of being away. I could also look at my screenshot, which happens to be a view of Nepal and the mountains. And so that I can get a sense of another world by simply closing down everything on my computer and looking at that photograph. So you don't have to physically go to a place. That might be better in terms of a kind of better mental restoration, but it doesn't have to be necessary for a very long time.
It could be just as simple as looking out, because from my studio here, I can look out and I see the Oslo Fjord and I see the surrounding city and the fjord. So it's a very beautiful view. So that could be for me just sort of getting away. The third one you said, the extent, where you said an environment is both legible and coherent, that it's easy to navigate. Could you elaborate a little more on that, what you mean by legible and coherent? I guess you're not talking about signage per se.
No, I'm not talking about science.
Okay, just making sure.
I mean, just on that piece, there's some really interesting experiments that have been done. One was done in Kensington in London, where they took away all the signage. And when you take everything away, the world kind of reverts back to a natural order. And people of all ages and all cognitive and physical abilities were able to navigate Kensington High Street, very busy high street, near all the museums in London. They were able to navigate that environment more comfortably and safely because a kind of self-order took over. Cars slowed right down, cyclists slowed right down because people were looking for pedestrians. Here in the US, I very rarely cycle because there's no kind of consciousness around looking out for either pedestrians or cyclists. So I'm not quite answering your question yet, but wayfinding and navigating your way around an environment depends very much upon the culture in which you do that. So in Copenhagen, you know, you come up out of the metro and you're immediately hit by the hush of the city and the kind of whoosh of the bikes, and there are no cars. It's just people walking and people cycling. And what I mean by a coherent and legible environment is you can make sense of it, and there are landmarks, there are nodes, there are connections which are coherently laid out. And it's not a question of signage. Signage can just actually confuse everything and make everything more difficult to interpret. A well-designed wayfinding system will have these nodes and points of intersection which kind of resonate and you will remember them. And so the next time you visit that environment, your kind of cognitive map in your head will kick in. It's quite a complex field, and people study this completely, exclusively. So it's kind of a sub-theme of restorative environments. There are a large number of people looking into how to create those coherent and legible environments. At the same time, because we know fascination is a quality of a restorative environment, those environments do need to have a little bit of mystery in them. You know, they don't want to be so bland that you're not curious to kind of find your way a little bit. It's a fine balance between the two.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, because, you know, I travel to London a lot. And when I'm in London, there's a lot of variation. But when I go to Canary Wharf, I mean, it's very laid out very well, but it seems, maybe this is not the right word, but it seems soulless to me. But when I'm in other parts of London, it just springs to life. There is that curiosity and that fascination. And there, it's that feeling to explore, to discover. The last point, you said environments that are compatible. So that's for mental states or physical states or age or maybe not ethnicity, but sort of maybe religions or something. Is that what you speak of, or genders?
Absolutely. It's important you feel a sense of fit and belonging in your environment. So it does relate to race and ethnicity and culture. Okay. And we're not very good in terms of urban design at really understanding the nuances of the cultural and social context in which we're working. So we don't do enough research to understand what it is people in a community really, really want and need. So a typical example of this I can cite from the UK was, we were doing some research and we discovered that a really vitally important cricket pitch had been removed in, I think it was Birmingham or Coventry, which has a very high proportion of Bangladeshi young adults who play cricket. They had taken this cricket pitch away without any consultation to create some other kind of green space. I don't know what it was necessarily, but they hadn't understood the vital needs of that particular culture to play cricket. And so they remove something really valuable. And we do that all the time, I think. You know, we don't really understand what a particular community needs.
And I guess by doing that, it almost hollows out that community, because if that becomes a central place where they gather or play a sport or have some sort of cultural event, that can psychologically hollow them out. You know, in the first part, Jenny talked about restorative cities and that there are four psychological processes that are associated with those restorative environments. The first is fascination, the fascination about our surroundings that triggers curiosity, the sense of wanting to go to explore and engage with the world, with that environment that's immediately in front of us. And that second process with the sense of being away. It's a sense of escaping from our daily stressors. And that could be as simple as sitting in a parquet on a bench and softening our gaze as we watch branches sway in the wind. It may be strolling along a riverside or a waterfront to take in the open expanse of a blue space, such as a lake or fjord or the ocean or a river. And the third part is the sense of extent, where we feel that our environment, the environment around us, is legible and coherent, that it's easy to navigate. There's a sense of certainty, a sense of intuitive direction to where we need to go. And the fourth, well, that environment has to be compatible with our needs. Depending on gender, depending on the sport we're doing, cycling or running, depending on our mental or physical capabilities. In the second part of our conversation, Jenny and I continue the conversation and talk about how city planners and urban designers and architectural firms can be more cognizant to create more restorative environments. And a great quote I love from Jenny's book is just this, quote, Restorative urbanism means putting mental health, wellness, and quality of life at the forefront of city planning and urban design. End quote. And I think that captures it so eloquently and so simply. So let's slip into the stream into part two of my conversation with Jenny Rowe. What are some of the benefits of these restorative environments on sort of, I guess, psychosocial, emotional health? I mean, what are some of the things that you've seen or you've measured or you've studied?
So I am involved in this research. And so we measure typically three things. We will look at stress and biomarkers of stress, including your daily cortisol concentrations. We will ask you how you feel about stress, because that's also very, very important. So we take subjective and physiological biomarkers of stress. We ask about mood and anxiety and depression. We ask about sleep levels. We ask about cognition. We may do kind of attentional tests. We may do memory tests. And all the time, just about in every instance, we find that any level of exposure to green space promotes recovery in all of those categories, both in mood, in cognition, and in stress. What's really interesting, though, I think that's kind of emerging in this body of research right now, is the impact, say, of a park on social capital, on your sense of place belonging, your sense of place attachment, your level of trust in a neighborhood. Some research has shown that neighborhoods with public parks are even more altruistic. The people in that community are more giving to that community in terms of, let's say, volunteer rates. So it's really powerful. And then there are all these physical health benefits too, which we talked about a little bit earlier. So if you can walk or cycle to work, your risk of getting a chronic health condition such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes is much reduced. So really, access to parks and nature in our cities is good for our whole holistic health. I really focus on the mental health benefits, but there are whole teams of researchers out there looking at the physical health benefits too.
I think it was in the Sensory City chapter where you were talking about where they were walking around with EEGs or these portable monitors, and they were measuring alpha and beta waves. And I think it was something, well, alpha is when you're in a sort of a relaxed state, and beta, just for my listeners, beta waves are more when you're concentrating on something. And I think that I read, you said urban environments where there's green spaces, the alpha waves are much higher than if it's just a sort of a static gray urban environment.
That's right. I mean, that's the study my lab has done. We did that study in Edinburgh, and we did it several times, and we were able to kind of replicate our results several times. And yeah, exactly what you just said, walking around trees and being in a park increased alpha wave activity, which is associated with relaxation.
I just find that amazing because, you know, after reading your book, I've become so cognizant, so conscious of all the different areas within Oslo. I mean, Oslo is not a huge city. It's about 700,000 people, I guess, size of Washington. But when you walk around, each of the different neighborhoods has its own feel. And there's somewhere you feel very, as you said, fascination and curiosity. And others you just kind of want to walk through. I think it's just that. It's the drab or these old sort of 1970s buildings. I can't remember what they called it. It's a type of architecture. Brutish, I think it was called, or something like that. And you just kind of want to walk past it. Or sometimes I find myself literally finding new ways to walk. It may be a little longer, but I feel psychologically, I don't know, in a better place. Maybe it's a sense of getting away, which you were talking about. So that leads me to my next question. You know, if you could characterize, what does a restorative street, what would that look like? Just on a sort of a crossroads in any city.
We visualize that in the book, as you will appreciate. The book is accompanied by some, I think, really beautiful illustrations, which were done by an architect. So the components of a restorative street I would say include street trees. They include traffic calming or a level of comfort, which minimizes vehicular access and maximizes space for walking and cycling.
The traffic calming, do you mean like speed bumps or reducing lane sizes or?
They're called, traffic calming is called different things in different worlds. So in the US, we talk about comfortable streets. In Europe, they talk about multimodal streets. So a multimodal street is a street that allows many forms of mobility and reduces the number of cars. The number of cars parked, the number of cars that are allowed to go through that street. And we saw these temporary pop-up changes in our streets during COVID, where the pavement was widened, the cycle path was added, the amount of space for vehicular transit and parking was reduced. Most cities, you know, around the world experienced that change. So a restorative street is a street in which those modes, other modes of transit are available. A restorative street would allow access to public transit, and it would allow seating and facilities associated with that transit to be incorporated. It would have what we call in the book fine-grained shop fronts. So the facades of that street would be curious and engaging. And there's a lot of research to show that those kind of curious and engaging shop fronts slows down traffic. People stop, pause, look, chat with each other. A restorative street would have space for seating, seating that's associated perhaps with restaurants and cafes, but seating that isn't associated with cafes and restaurants that anybody can just sit down and enjoy without having to pay use of that seating. It would need to have facilities, you know, for young children, for older adults, people who might need to use a bathroom more often. It needs to have those kind of facilities. It might have Wi-Fi points, you know, in terms of building Wi-Fi equity. There's a whole host of these types of attributes we talk about in the book.
Yeah, so fine grains, I really like that term because box malls doesn't really do it for me with these huge parking lots. So I agree. And I think that's a way of sort of regenerating city centers because at least in North America, you have these huge box malls like Walmart and Target. And it just sucks the life out of small city centers or small village centers. And I think it sounds like to me, well, at least what I see in Canada, where I'm from, there's more of an encouragement to build up some of the high streets or the main streets of some of the smaller towns and villages. You've written a complete book on urban design and connecting it to mental health and well-being. Do you see that there is an effort to connect urban planning with public health practices?
I think it's happening in some cities.
Okay.
But it's happening slowly. And it's not happening fast enough. So I think it's happening in Boston here in the US. They have a very smart, integrated urban planning and public health framework. Mm. I think it's happening in some Canadian cities. Vancouver also has a sort of healthy city model it's working towards. Scotland is one of the few countries that has a national plan for this. It has a national public health and well-being and built environmental policy. It's doing case studies in certain areas, and it's also got a 15-minute city kind of framework it's developing. I think some of the Australian cities have a similar framework. I've not been to Australia. I don't know those examples quite so well. I think Paris is doing a lot of work right now to make itself a restorative city. Mm. Some of those changes we've talked about during this podcast in relation to COVID-19, multimodal streets, Paris has really taken that to heart. And the mayor of Paris, she was reelected on the mandate of an urban design that would make those changes permanent. They are closing streets around schools to provide safe transit for children, to cycle to school, to play in the streets. So it's happening. I think New Zealand also has a public health and urban planning framework. But these are isolated examples, right? I mean, I can probably count on my two hands the number of examples that I know. Now, it may be happening in other places that I don't know about, but these are the ones I know about.
Okay. Do you feel sort of the architectural industry has been sort of bringing this in? Are they more conscious or cognizant how to link mental health with urban design? Do you find there are architectural industries or in certain parts of cities where they're focusing on this more and more?
I wish I had a positive message to give you there. Okay. I work and train students in the context of the US.
Yes.
And I call this approach to design human-centered design. You know, it's about understanding the impact of what you're designing, what you're creating on the individual, their health and well-being and their behavior. And the students who take my courses tell me every architect should be trained in the principles of human-centered design. Every urban designer should be trained in those principles, but that isn't what's happening. Certainly in the field of architecture in the US, there are some schools doing a good job, but it's not leading the field of architecture. You know, theory and aesthetics can lead that field. So I think there is good work being done. But when I talk to people who are doing that work, we all say the same thing. We feel like we're many years ahead of ourselves, particularly in relation to mental health, and that people aren't taking this field seriously enough. And we do have, I think, post-COVID, if we can even say we're post-COVID, we do have this sort of tsunami of mental health issues that are rising to the surface. We don't even know yet the effect of isolation, let's say, on young children. You know, we're still wrestling with that, but we do know that the age group 16 to 24 are experiencing high levels of anxiety right now across the world. And I see it in my own students. So I just think we're not moving fast enough. And I really feel COVID threw open a door of opportunity for urban design. We could really make our mark in this period. I feel we'll be judged by future populations, future generations, about what we did post-COVID to change and better and make more equitable our cities. And it's happening in some places, but it's not happening fast enough.
Just to challenge you here, you know, if cities are kind of are facing a lot of challenges, such as budget constraints with, for example, this maybe looming recession, if it's not already landed, you know, crumbling infrastructure, what should urban designers do? I mean, what should they focus? If they have a small budget, why should they focus on that and not fixing sort of these needed infrastructures?
Well, I think the infrastructure needs to be looked at. And I think that we need to bring public health to the table. And the way you bring public health to the table in terms of urban design is you put robust scientific evidence in front of them and say that they need to have that evidence. That was one rationale for generating the book. But also, I'm a big believer in working bottom up, you know, small scale interventions at a community level can have a lot of impact on that community. But the one word I'd use is connections, called connectivity. These efforts need to be connected. So let's say you develop a little pocket park in your neighborhood. You know, you get together with your local community, you take over, let's say, some areas that were used for parking, and you decide to create a micro pocket park, and you get permission, et cetera, from your whatever governance framework to do so. That's great. But to really benefit, it needs to be connected to another pocket park along a safe street that incorporates street trees. So it's about connecting these things. And one thing I always say to city planners is where to start with a restorative city framework is to plot your assets. See where you've got those pocket spaces or murals or water features or fountains. See where they are. And then think about how you can build a bigger infrastructure by connecting them together.
The connectivity, what does that do? Does that create a sense of flow? Does that create a sense of this, the ease of getting around, easy to navigate, where it's almost intuitive? So if I walk into this park, I see sort of my curiosity or my fascination or the sense of discovery leads me down this lane or down this road to the next parkette or the next fountain or a mural or something.
So a good question. So what connectivity does is, I think, two things. It makes us more mobile. You know, in terms of walking and cycling, it makes it easier for us to navigate that environment. And it also does exactly what you just said. It makes that environment more comfortable to be in for longer.
And there is that curiosity. And again, I use Oslo just because it's my closest reference. Now, I don't know if this has been consciously done, but when I walk through the city, if you would strip off all the signs, it'd just be intuitive which way I have to go, where it's safe to cross, where it's okay to, I don't know, just to sit down and relax. That's why I found your book so fascinating. I mean, I read a couple of chapters a day, but when I was out and about meeting clients, everything that you wrote about, Jeniak, is just kind of, it's kind of spring to life. Oslo, for me, was almost a living example of your book brought to life.
That's great feedback, and I clearly need to get to Oslo and witness that myself, but I think your feedback is just so valuable for me to hear, so I really appreciate you, reading the book, giving me an opportunity to talk about it, but also, you know, that it resonates with your experience of your everyday life in Oslo.
Yeah, you know, I'm just a commuter that goes to the city to get to where I have to go, but one thing about your book that really also, you know, it was the active city you wrote and the inclusive city and the playful city. I kind of melded those together. And on like Saturday and Sunday mornings, when everyone's kind of asleep, my kids are asleep and such, I get up in the morning and I go for these long morning runs, and the city streets are mine. There's nobody else, maybe the early dog walker, but all of this intuitive places where to go, this fascination, this curiosity, and that sense of getting away, that really resonated with me when you said that. It's not I have to physically go, but when I'm out running, you know, I feel safe everywhere in Oslo. But when I'm running, it's that I feel like I'm getting away because I'm flowing in from one neighborhood, changes to another, and it changes to another. And each has its own distinct characteristic or almost personality. We've been talking about urban developers, city planners, architects that can shape the city and such. And you spoke to where maybe a community, a neighborhood can go out and fix something, take a parking lot and make it a park. Are there suggestions that my listeners could take to heart and maybe change something in their neighborhood to create this connectivity?
So something I would flag for communities that they can do, we call it tactical urbanism. It's making some temporary changes in your environment before any permanent change is made. So typically you'll see it in terms of street painting. So I was talking to somebody, an urban planner here in Charlottesville, who was complaining about the safety of a route that children walk to school along. And he said, "Jenny, I feel like going out in the middle of the night and doing some guerrilla tactical urbanism with my paint cans and changing, you know, just a simple mural on the surface of a road can slow cars down and make them think, am I supposed to stop here?" I've seen it here in Charlottesville at the intersection of roads around schools, very elaborate kind of murals across that junction, which indicate to you something's changed here. I need to slow my car down. Something needs to, you know, I need to change my behavior. Typically, they're best done not in a guerrilla way, but with the permission of your local council. And they might include, you know, putting in a cycleway or widening the sidewalk or reducing some traffic. So there's organizations around the world that specialize in these tactical urbanism interventions. We have one in the US called Street Plans Collaborative. And residents and neighbors can get ideas from these websites and talk to their local governance officers about trying to make those changes. And it's a really good way of experimenting before permanent change is made. And that's super cheap. All you need is some paint and some volunteers.
And I guess this comes back up to that sort of pop-up, what you're talking about, to experiment with things. And if it goes well, okay, let's make it permanent. So in a sense, it's a little bit of a trial and error.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Jenny Rowe, thank you very much for spending some time with me and sharing your ideas. I thought it was a fascinating book, and especially when connected to resilience and resilient cities and how that urban design and city planning should be taken more into contact with mental health and well-being.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to your audience today. And please reach out if I can answer any further questions.
Thank you, Jenny. Thanks for your time today. Well, folks, that was Jenny Rowe. She's the co-author of Restorative Cities, Urban Design for Mental Health and Well-Being, which looks at how city planners and architects can approach the design of cities with mental health in mind. Thanks again, Jenny, for taking the time to join me on this podcast and to share your knowledge and your experience about creating restorative cities. You know, as I said at the top of the episode, you know, once you listen to this episode, you'll never see your city in the same light. You will see it in such greater nuance and vibrancy. And to understand these little things that kind of trigger this sense of well-being when we walk through certain parts of the city, or what detracts from that well-being when we walk through other parts of the city. You know, as a Canadian, I am very fortunate to live in Oslo. Over the last 20 years, I have seen this city just explode in the sense of design and development. And as I said during the interview, Oslo is almost like a living representative of Jenny's book. I mean, Oslo city planners and urban developers have really thought about the blue spaces and the green spaces. They are constantly building a city that is much more inclusive, much more active, much more playable. From my own perspective, Oslo architecturally is not a static city. There is so much variability that triggers curiosity and fascination. And I'd also have to concur with Jenny about Stockholm and Copenhagen, another two beautiful, beautiful cities where it just you want to explore these cities. You want to walk the avenues. So for any of my international listeners out there that are curious about finding their next destination, the next holiday destination, well, Copenhagen, Oslo, or Stockholm would be great choices. Anyways, folks, if you wish to get in contact with Jenny, I will leave all her contact information in the show notes, as well as a direct link to her highly recommended book. Anyways, as a call to action, dear listeners, if you could please subscribe, rate, and review this episode on the podcast, I'd really appreciate it. And if you could please share it with two family members, two colleagues, or two friends, you would be doing me a huge solid. Anyways, until next week, until the next time we speak and meet again, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon. Oh,